This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
Today we're bringing you part 4 of Missing in the Keys, the story of 16-year-old Cindy Gooding and 12-year-old Terry Alfonso, who went missing from Marathon, Florida in 1974. We've heard from family members and friends of the girls about the last time they were both seen or spoken to, and we've tried to retrace their last known movements, but we're still no closer to an answer of what happened that fateful night. And if you thought we might be getting close to the end of the story, think again.
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
We've covered a lot of detail in the previous 3 episodes, so if you haven't already, go back and take a listen. And we're introducing some new names, so check out the who's who in the show notes for this episode on our website at apbcoldcase.com. All persons are presumed innocent. We're not alleging that any of the people we'll be talking about are official suspects or persons of interest. In the previous episode, we just learned that a dangerous member of the outlaw motorcycle gang, James Walter Sterrett, escaped custody from a hospital in Key West about 1 month before Cindy and Terry disappeared. He was on the lam. Was he holed up somewhere in the Keys? It's possible. And then, on September 4, 1974, just 1 day after Terry and Cindy were reported missing, an associate of Sterrett's named John Earl Smith also escaped custody, but he escaped from a prison on Big Pine Key, about 20 miles south of Marathon. Some reports indicate that Sterrett may have assisted Smith in his escape. If true, that puts him within proximity and time of the disappearance of our girls. Was that tip given to police correct? The one we mentioned in an earlier episode about Cindy having a possible association with the outlaw gang? And did she actually know James Walter Sterrett? Terry Alfonso's nephew-in-law, Kevin, has often wondered about that.
I mean, it would be very crazy in my mind, and I've put it through it a few times to think of this, but if the people whom Darlene and the other girls was sitting with in a trailer were outlaw biker members, and one of them was James Sterrett, it would be something else.
By 1974, Sterrett is already known as a dangerous man. Let's take a quick look at his extensive and incredibly violent criminal past. Just after Christmas 1970, he brutally murdered 31-year-old Susan Bacon in Broward County, Florida. According to court papers, Susan was at a party at Sterrett's house when she got into an argument with an outlaw member and she slapped him. When Sterrett saw that, he began beating her. Later that evening, some of the outlaws took Susan into a bedroom to be, quote, trained. Afterward, Susan announced that she wanted to be taken to a police station. Sterrett's response? He was going to feed her to the gators. Sterrett and another man drove Susan to a remote area in Broward County. There, Sterrett shot her twice in the chest at close range with a shotgun and once with a handgun. News reports say that Sterrett was arrested and eventually convicted for her murder. So, that conviction was in 1971, and as we know, he escaped from custody in the Keys in July 1974, and then his associate, John Earl Smith, escaped September 4th, possibly with the help of Sterrett, the day after Terry and Cindy are reported missing. Are Sterrett and Smith somehow involved in our case? Kevin told me that Sterrett was questioned about the girl's disappearance.
Detective Mark Coleman, that's yes. The one we met with in Marathon. He was very good at getting people in coordination and communication with other states' detective agencies. What he did was is he was able to track James Sterrett down in his home state of Tennessee, and they questioned him then. And of course, they tried to question him. He wouldn't be questioned and denied everything, apparently. So.
And what about Sterrett's buddy Smith? Well, it was decades later, in 2010, when John Earl Smith was himself the victim of a robbery in California. When Monroe County, Florida detectives heard about this, they asked police in Inglewood, California, to help them in following up on any possible connection to the disappearance of Terry and Cindy. Detectives first showed Smith pictures of James Walter Sterrett to verify their relationship. Then, they showed him pictures of Cindy and Terry. Those detectives reported that Smith did acknowledge knowing Sterrett, but denied ever knowing or seeing the girls. They said that Smith did not show any signs of deception during that interview. So we wondered if Sterrett owned a vehicle that matched up with the circumstances of the girls' disappearance. Kevin told us about a conversation he had with a former detective who'd worked on the case.
In those years, Sterrett had a van, and that van was a white panel van. They did do some research on that as well.
There's that white panel van again. Police continue to work the outlaw theory, and in 2010, detectives showed pictures of Sterrett and Smith to Terry Alfonso's sister Darlene and her mom Mercedes. But it was reported that they did not recognize either of the men. Neither did Terry Pease Cameron, the girl who witnessed Terry and Cindy getting into a van on 92nd Street. When she was interviewed by police in 2010, she said she was not aware of any relationship between Cindy and a motorcycle gang member, nor was she familiar with any escaped prisoners at the time. So, despite the fact that Sterrett and others associated with him have violent criminal histories, and the fact that the escapes of both Sterrett and Smith do coincide with the disappearance of Cindy and Terry, ultimately, police didn't find any connection between Sterrett or Smith and our missing girls. But Sterrett wasn't the only outlaw member to frequent the Florida Keys. I asked former resident Barb if she remembered them being in Marathon back in the 70s.
Occasionally they would come through, but we knew just to stay away from them later on, much, much later in life. I met a guy that used to hang out at the Overseas, and he was part of the outlaw motorcycle gang. We became close enough where he started telling me stories. Scary stories about how they would kidnap young girls. And one that he told me about was the one that they found in Fort Lauderdale tied to a coconut tree who had been raped to death. I think he had a lot of guilt and regret.
And before we step away from the outlaws, there's another former gang member that caught our attention. Joseph Spaziano, known as Crazy Joe, was convicted for the 1973 murder of an 18-year-old woman in Orlando, Florida. But he was not in custody when Cindy and Terry disappeared. Prison records show that he's still currently incarcerated for that Orlando murder and also serving a life sentence for sexual battery for the savage rape and mutilation of another Orlando teen. So he's just one more predator committing unspeakable crimes in Florida during the time our girls went missing. And sadly, we haven't even scratched the surface yet. Another sadistic man comes on the radar in the 70s. His crimes were committed in Florida. His victims, teenage girls. And his occupation, well, it's alarming. Terry Alfonso's sister Bonnie told me about this lead.
So in 1974, something happened there, maybe foul play, whatever. All these girls that they're finding tied up to the mangroves, this one that they just found not long ago, I think it was in the East Coast, like I guess around the Fort Lauderdale, Del Rey area. She was tied to mangroves, and it comes to find out it was a cop. He was killing girls. So, you know, that's not far from the key.
The man she's talking about is Gerard Schaefer, the serial killer who also happened to be a cop. According to reports, a 15-year-old girl went missing from Broward County in 1972. Her skeletal remains were found in a mangrove swamp 2 years later in 1974 on Singer Island. She was reportedly tied to a tree with wire. But 5 months before she went missing, two other teenage girls were hitchhiking near Palm Beach when Martin County Sheriff's Deputy Gerard Schaefer stopped them. Schaefer had them get in his patrol car, and he drove them to their apartment, warning them about the dangers of hitchhiking, and then offered to take them to the beach the next morning. He picked them up as planned, but instead of taking them to the beach, he drove them to a shed on Hutchinson Island, 100 miles north of Miami. Schaefer gagged the girls and tied them to trees where they had to balance themselves on tree roots while nooses were tied around their necks. And then he left them there. Fortunately, the traumatized girls were both able to escape, one reportedly swimming across a river with her hands still tied behind her. She got herself to a road when a police car suddenly appeared. But this time, it was the sheriff himself. The other victim had already been assisted by a motorist. When Schaefer later returned to the area and realized the girls had escaped, he called his boss and admitted to what he'd done. According to Cairo TV News, Schaefer told the sheriff that he had, quote, overdone his job in trying to teach the girls a lesson about the dangers of hitchhiking. Schaefer was fired and charged with false imprisonment and aggravated assault. But while out on bail and awaiting trial, he struck again. And sadly, this time, his victims would not escape. It was in September of that year, 1972, when two other teen girls went off to a Fort Lauderdale beach and would never come back. They were last seen by the mother of one of the girls getting into a car with an older man who was described as a friend of the girls. Something about that didn't sit quite right with Mom because she wrote down the license plate number of the car. And when those girls didn't return home, she gave the information to detectives who would trace the car back to Gerard Schaefer. It was about 6 months later when the girls' bodies were found on Hutchinson Island. They'd been beheaded and dismembered. And the location where they were found was just miles from where Schaefer had tied up the other two victims who'd managed to escape. So is there a connection to our case? The locations we're talking about are north of the Keys, and the victims, who were traveling in pairs, are about the same age as Terry and Cindy. But there's a problem. Reports say that Schaefer's a potential suspect in up to 30 murders from the mid-60s to 1973, but we found that Schaefer was in jail at the time our girls vanished. He had been convicted of the murders of those two girls found on Hutchinson Island, and he was sentenced to life in prison. So that eliminates him as a suspect in the disappearance of Terry and Cindy. And to close out this chapter completely, in 1995, Schaefer, the man who one prosecutor described as the most sexually deviant person he'd ever seen, a man who made Ted Bundy look like a Boy Scout, was stabbed to death in prison by another inmate. And we should at least mention serial killer Gerald Stano, because he fits our timeline. According to news reports, Stano admitted to the murders of 41 women in Florida, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. His M.O.? Picking up young female hitchhikers and then killing them when they refused his advances. One of his victims, a 17-year-old hitchhiker, had been stabbed to death sometime between 1973 and 1974, her body found in Central Florida. Stano was convicted for 10 murders in Florida and received the death penalty in three of those cases. He was executed in 1998. So his known crimes put him in proximity, being the state of Florida, but we found nothing that ties him to Marathon or the Keys, and nothing to indicate that Monroe County sheriffs ever considered him a suspect in the disappearance of our girls. And that brings us to yet another dangerous individual, but this guy has a connection to the Keys, and more specifically, to Marathon. Anthony Lorette allegedly stabbed and slit the throat of 25-year-old Jeanette Mickey Wade, a young mother who in 1976 was home alone with her baby in Marathon, Florida. Barb, the former resident we spoke with earlier, is familiar with the murder of the woman they called Mickey.
She was killed in her home in the kitchen, and they said they found the knife in the backyard where you'd hang up clothes, like the metal post, you put up a metal T-post. And then the lines would go from each T-post. He had stuck the knife in the arm of the T-post. And then they said they found her panties in the lagoon, which was right down the road. And the baby was found out of the crib next to her dying mother. When her husband would come home, he came home every afternoon for lunch. When he came home, that's what he found.
Barb said she'd heard that Jeanette's murder was a case of mistaken identity. She explained that a local fishing boat captain had hired a drifter, presumably Anthony Lorette, to work on his boat. And one day, the boat was chartered by a prominent Marathon resident and his wife.
And when his wife came down to the dock, I mean, this is a story that was told by people that knew them. And she said, oh, great. You hired another dirtbag. Well, that guy, he was crazy. He was a serial killer. He was a serial rapist killer. So his intentions were to kill the wife, but he screwed up and he got the wrong house. and ended up killing the Wade girl.
Barb said she thought that police initially believed Jeanette Mickey Wade was murdered by her husband.
They didn't find out until like years later, and it was so devastating for the family. They left the keys. They owned the Gulf gas station. They sold out, sold their home. My mom and dad actually bought her mom and dad's home.
Jeanette Mickey Wade was not murdered in her parents' home. She was actually murdered just a few streets away, but Barb still had an uneasy feeling.
We moved in, and from day one, that house was creepy. This is like 76. I remember my parents were out of town. My sister came down from Fort Lauderdale, and she said a guy came to the door asking questions about Mickey Wade. And I'm like, well, what did he look like? Did you call the police? And she's like, no, he said he was an insurance, something about insurance. And I'm like, that's bullshit. You know, and I often wonder, God, was that guy coming back? You know, I don't know, in my mind, but I was like so terrified.
Was it Anthony Lorette that came to their door? It's frightening to think so. According to published reports, Lorette was finally apprehended in 1980. He confessed to 30 murders, rapes, and assaults in 11 states, including the murder of Jeanette Wade. Lorette was initially charged for her murder, but was never extradited, any prosecution becoming fruitless, considering that he was facing the death penalty in Missouri for other crimes. Lorette was reportedly known to kill hitchhikers and dump their bodies during his travels. This included two young girls who he claimed were buried in a rural area that's now a shopping center near Tampa. He was executed in 1995 for the murder of a 19-year-old girl in Missouri. Even though he claimed knowledge of 30 murders and rapes, and one of his alleged victims was killed in Marathon, detectives in Florida did not find any connection between Lorette and the disappearance of our girls, but they've never completely eliminated him either. And if we're talking about prolific killers of young women who were active in the 70s, let's not forget Bobby Jack Fowler. Why is he on our radar? Well, a story in the Oregonian said that Fowler may have killed 20 or more girls, including a missing 16-year-old hitchhiker in 1974. Other reports about Fowler's crime track him in several states across the U.S. The Oregonian quoted a detective who said that Fowler tried to protect himself by rabbiting across the country. Was he so mobile that he could have been in the Florida Keys in 1974? And while it is possible, we found nothing to suggest that. Fowler died in prison in Oregon in 2006. And while Fowler couldn't be linked to the Keys, we heard about another guy who was. Let's talk about Carl Charlie Brandt. A 2006 episode of 48 Hours covered the bizarre story of Brandt, a resident of Big Pine Key, who in 2004 fled with his wife ahead of Hurricane Ivan to ride out the storm with a relative in Orlando. Shockingly, all three of their bodies were discovered days later in that Orlando home. Brandt's wife had been stabbed 7 times. Her niece had been stabbed once, then decapitated and her heart removed. And Brandt himself was found hanging by a bedsheet in the garage. It was after this gruesome discovery that Brandt's sister came forward to divulge a dark family secret. In 1971, when Brandt was just 13, he'd fatally shot his pregnant mother and tried to kill his father. He spent 1 year in a state mental facility, and according to reports, after he was released, the family moved to Ormond Beach, Florida. A 2006 article in the Orlando Sentinel reported that Brandt was also suspected in the unsolved murder of Sherry Parisho in Monroe County, Florida in 1989. Could Brandt be linked to the disappearance of our girls? He would have been 17 years old when Cindy and Terry disappeared. But there's still another Florida predator with a van that we need to talk about. His name is Robert Clark Keebler. According to the Broward County Sheriff's Office and published reports, in June 1975, two 14-year-old friends were sitting on a bench on a busy street in Hollywood, Florida. Witnesses saw the girl hop inside a white van. The next morning, their bodies were discovered by a family on a fishing outing in the Everglades. The girls had been assaulted and shot to death. DNA testing led to Keebler as their suspect, who's now deceased. His criminal history included armed robbery, aggravated assault, and sexual assault from California to South Florida. Detectives are still looking for tips to determine the connection between Keebler and those two murdered girls. That crime occurred 130 miles from Marathon and 9 months after Terry and Cindy vanished. The proximity and victimology are noteworthy, but we can't confirm if Keebler had any connection. So, let's move on. You may have heard of Rodney Alcala, also known as the Dating Game Killer, since he was a contestant on a TV game show by the same name. According to several reports, in 1979, while investigating Alcala for the murder of a 12-year-old girl in California, detectives searched his Seattle storage locker, where they discovered a cache of photos, many of them young women in suggestive poses. The discovery led authorities to try to identify the women in the photos. Cindy Gooding's sister, Diane, told me that a reporter reached out to her about those photos and her missing sister, Cindy.
Like I had told you, the Rodney Alcala, and how many people, families they were trying to get a hold of to go through this, I could not believe it. I couldn't believe it when I saw all the pictures. No telling how many women that man killed.
Diane said that thankfully none of the pictures were of Cindy. According to the California Department of Corrections, investigators have either suspected or linked Alcala to murders in several states across the U.S., including California and New York. And some reports say his victims could number as many as 130. Like some of the other killers we've discussed, we're unable to confirm if Alcala ever visited or had ties to Florida. And just when you thought we were out of predators, there's Christopher Wilder, who was born in Australia. In 1962, 17-year-old Wilder was involved in the gang rape of a 13-year-old girl in Sydney. Years later, he became the subject of another sex crime. Those charges would be dropped, but in between the 1962 gang rape and the 1968 sex crime allegation, there was a double murder of two 15-year-old girls not far from Wilder's home in Australia called the Wanda Beach Killings, said to be one of Australia's most well-known cases, which remains unsolved to this day. So, why are we talking about someone from Australia? Well, it was in the 1970s when Wilder immigrated to Florida and became a home contractor. Reports say that between 1971 and 1975, Wilder was charged with several sexual misconduct crimes, one where he enticed a teenager so he could photograph her. This incident happens around the time that Terry Alfonso and Cindy Gooding disappear. Wilder would ultimately be connected with the disappearance or murders of young women in Florida, Arizona, Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, and New York. The FBI was tracking all those crimes when in 1984, about 10 years after our girls went missing, Wilder faced off with New Hampshire troopers after an attempted abduction. Again, we don't know if Wilder had any connection to the Keys, but the proximity of his other alleged crimes in Florida and his M.O. certainly raises suspicion. You can hear more about the crimes of Christopher Wilder in our episode, Last Stop of the Beauty Queen Killer. Let's get back to our case. So when you look at the victimology of our two missing girls, Terry and Cindy, they were young, carefree, and trusting, routinely hitchhiking, naive to the dangers of the world, and during an era when drugs were prevalent. And for the predators we just discussed, the harsh truth is they were hunting for victims in a target-rich environment. Most of them preyed upon vulnerable young women, luring them on a pretense, maybe the offer of a party or a ride to the beach. And these are just the guys we know about. But what about the ones we're not familiar with, the ones who have flown under the radar? You'll remember we discussed the sometimes questionable transient population moving in and out of the Keys. Former resident Barb told me about the local fishing industry. Her father owned and operated a fleet of boats and one of the fish houses in Marathon. He often hired people just passing through, who needed money, and who didn't mind doing the, let's just say, the less desirable jobs.
My father had a seafood packing company and retail stores. It was a big production, so we had a lot of people coming in and out. Many, many local fishermen, and also he hired a lot of very colorful people. And, I mean, there were no background checks or anything like that, and a lot of them were a little hairy, scary, and I would always say, Dad, are you sure about that? You guys, that couldn't get a job that my father would hire just to do the grunt work that nobody else wanted to do, like grinding chum and cutting up shark bait.
She said that many of them had criminal records.
Probably at least 75% of them did. They were drug addicts, alcoholics, and did prison time. I know a few of them. And we also, at the fish house, we would rent out dock slips where, you know, we were probably the cheapest people in town, where you could just pull up, put your sailboat or your boat, houseboat, whatever, and stay there for a month, 2 months at a time at a very, very low cost.
Could this transient population account for any of the other cold cases in the Keys from the 1970s? One of those cases we touched on earlier is the brutal murder of Marguerite and Mary Jenkins, teenage sisters found beaten and shot to death in a wooded area of Key Largo in 1973. They were last seen hitchhiking, and as of the production of this episode, their case is still unsolved. In our research, we've also come across local stories of the No-Name Killer and the Devil Worshipper murders, and sadly, we could go on and on. The Keys were a destination for all kinds of people, and maybe some of them had evil intentions. Then you have this young population, and there wasn't a lot for kids to do. Former resident Sharon remembered those days of 50 years ago.
Back in the 70s, we didn't have a lot of places to go. There wasn't much to do for teenagers. Young people like myself, those girls, we were just oblivious to danger, oblivious. Everywhere we went, everyone had the same attitude. There was absolutely nothing to do for teenagers. So everyone was so thirsty, so to speak, for socializing and being with other people and doing things.
Was the disappearance of our girls a crime of opportunity by someone passing through?
The Keys were like a magnet to transient people. It was very cheap living, and a lot of people lived on boats. A lot of people lived in trailers and mobile homes, and there was just so many people that were not all from the same area. It was a big, huge melting pot. So there's a good possibility those girls ran into people or a person that was passing through and either left Marathon unwillingly.
Or was the danger already living among them?
Maybe they fell into the wrong hands, and people that have boats have access to going out to the water and dumping things. So it's possible. I don't believe they ran away, and I don't believe that they are buried anywhere in Marathon. I just feel like it had, back then it would have been so easy for something terrible to happen to them.
Coming up in part 5 of Missing in the Keys, we've looked at quite a few dangerous predators from all over the country who were active when Terry and Cindy went missing. Is it time for us to focus a little bit closer to home?
The street that we lived on, 92nd Street, there was a lady that was gardening and started finding bones. They started digging, and they did find 2 bodies.
What other secrets will be uncovered?
And the FBI is coming up this evening. I called my mother, and she said, tell them the truth. And so the guy came, and I talked to him, and I told him.
That's coming up in part 5 of Missing in the Keys. If you or anyone you know has information about the disappearance of 12-year-old Terry Alfonso or 16-year-old Cindy Gooding from Marathon, Florida in 1974, you can call Crime Stoppers anonymously at 866-471-TIPS or go to crimestoppers305.com or call 1-800-THE-LOST. Don't forget to check out our show notes for photos of Cindy and Terry, including age-progressed images, and for historical photos of Marathon, a who's who of the people mentioned in this episode, a timeline, maps, and more.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.